Page 17, Side 2, March 5th, 1979, House Committee on Judiciary, Full Committee Work Session, Senate Bill 68, House Bill 2011, House Bill 2017, House Bill 2020, House Bill 2052, House Bill 2063, House Bill 2067, House Bill 2069, House Bill 2073, House Bill 2295, House Bill 2299.
The judiciary have come to order. Clerk of Officers in the presence, the balance are excused. The first bill up for work session will be House Bill 2299. The ratification of those members of the audience that may be here on either Senate Bill 68 or House Bill 2052 will be taking up those bills a little later in the agenda. 68 will come up first. It's my intention to deal with almost everything else on the agenda before we get to House Bill 2052. So if you're here on House Bill 2052, I'd suggest you take a long coffee break. It may be a while.
Does that mean members all come?
2299.
Light up the audience.
Joan?
2299 is a bill that would allow the defendant to waive pre-sentence report. Was heard by Subcommittee 1 on the 19th of February. An amendment was suggested and it was sent to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation. The effect of the amendment is to allow the court also to have a say in whether or not the pre-sentence report is waived, so that the substantive part of the amendment is after line 18, insert B, the court determines that such a report is unnecessary.
Okay.
So the defendant requests that he be sentenced without the use of the pre-sentence report, and the court agrees that the report is unnecessary.
I believe that the amendment that's been handed to you, dated 2279, puts us in the position where the subcommittee decides that we should be, which would be to allow the court and the defendant to agree that a pre-sentence report was not necessary. It rejects the position that it would require that the district attorney also consent that the pre-sentence report was not necessary. The point being, I think in the subcommittee, we kind of took the position that the court would be probably very greatly influenced by the district attorney's recommendation whether or not a pre-sentence report would be required. Let's also bring up Mr. Watson's proposed amendment at this time. Do you want to read that?
Okay. The suggestion is to read section 3 as it exists and insert, unless the court orders otherwise, when the facts necessary to determine the ranges of duration of imprisonment and any aggravating or mitigating circumstances provided in ORS 144.780 and ORS 144.785 have been established by the court, a sentence shall be imposed without a pre-sentence report.
Yeah. Mr. Watson, would you like to talk to Mr. Secretary? I read the language and I was a little unclear to me. What is your intention with that amendment?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Bob Watson. The House Committee of 1977 passed some sweeping changes in this whole area of pre-sentence and parole board and court relationship to one another, including a whole variety of things. Ordering the court to state on the record why it sentenced people, and requiring the parole board to do a whole new adopt the rules on how they operate. Two of those key provisions are in these ORS cited in the proposed amendment. Having to do with establishing rules for duration and rules for aggravation mitigation. My belief is that without some continuation of the mandatory pre-sentence provision, as soon as the whole frame of reference, we even crumble and be less and less means to be so careful in the determination of ranges and aggravation mitigation, particularly with the base document, the pre-sentence report, not being provided in large number of cases. So, in my position alone, we should retain the mandatory provision unless we can find some good alternative. This might provide.
Could you explain the amendment? I don't understand the language. It's the when it would or would not apply.
My belief is that if the court could find in open court, so it's established in the due process arena, items such as the range or the items of aggravation mitigation, in all instances, you would need no pre-sentence report. And that seems to be the basis for appeal and it makes the parole board's decision. Appeal that they may direct the court of appeals on the one thing in the location is the parole board in these two areas. And I sit as a liaison member to that board of prison terms and parole standards with the five parole board members and five judges. That was a suggestion that was discussed by that commission as a means to overcome some of the appeal problems. And so it just came to me that perhaps this would also be a way we could deal with the mandatory pre-sentence provisions that if there was that finding made in court, that there would be a little need for pre-sentence support. That's my reading.
Okay,
what's
what you said here, Bill, language means that any prior convictions you would have to be, you know, the court would have had to be aware of those before they issue any kind of waiting of the pre-sentence report, as a minimum. Anything else
you
have to gather?
Well, the parole board has some elaborate rules on how they determine aggravation mitigation. Included is such items as sentences or charges that were waived or bargained down or dismissed based upon the current conviction. I see other examples would be establishing in the court the fact of prior convictions. Sometimes that's contested and they say, well, that's a mistake on my rap sheet. I really was not convicted of that. Those could be determined in court at the time of sentencing. The whole system would function better.
Okay, further questions? Okay. Is there, you've heard the amendment. Do we have any motion? Substance Mason?
I would move the adoption of the proposed amendment on the sheet dated
2/22/79. Okay, Representative Mason moved that the House Bill 2299 be amended by The amendment has been handed out to you by staff dated 2/22/79, proposed amendment to House Bill 2299. Discussion.
Mr. How does the last part of that then, the after 9/18 amendment, jive with what Mr. Watson has just asked for in the form of an amendment? Are we changing Section 3 altogether by Mr. Watson's amendment?
Yes.
And
Mr. Watson's amendment would delete Section 3.
Okay, and the proposed amendment that we have them on this sheet want to amend line 18, so I mean, we're going to be amending line 18 twice if we vote this in toto.
Well, if we, I would assume that we would pick one or the other. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I understand Representative Mason's motion to include this amendment having to do with line 18, and I would guess we're going to have another one in a moment on line 18 again.
Okay.
Well, my motion in it is the adoption of the 2/22/79 language as opposed to Mr. Watson's language, speaking to the amendment itself, and conversely speaking to Mr. Watson's amendment. I do think the courts are aware of those things now that he spoke to. I do think that the prior convictions are always brought up by district attorneys who are doing their job. I don't think that Mr. Watson's language is really necessary. The original purpose of this bill and the continuing purpose, and I think the amendments are consistent with it, are to cure the legally closed situations where a pre-sentence report just simply is not necessary. I think we've heard some of the descriptions from both witnesses and members of this committee as the situations which occur where a pre-sentence report is not necessary, and the waiting for the pre-sentence report merely confines the inmate, either keeps him in jail and he shouldn't be in jail because he can't bail or he can't be recogged, or the situation where he's kept in the county jail and should return to the state prison, or the situation such as I related where he's kept in Oregon where he should be merely returned to another state to do some other time elsewhere. And the intent of the original bill is good, and I think the intent of the amendment is good.
Before we have further discussion, Judge Beatty, did you have something you wanted to add at this point?
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, John Beatty, representing the Judicial Conference. I think I have the greatest personal sympathy with Mr. Watson's desire to hold on to the mechanism that was created last time. I think that the advisory committee on parole standards and periods of confinement, if the bill is adopted without the language suggested by Mr. Watson, will have to revise their rules to deal with aggravation and mitigation. It is my impression that can be done under the existing statute. It does mean that the information collected in a pre-sentence report will have to be collected in a post-sentence report, which will prepare exactly the same material that would be available in a pre-sentence report, where the pre-sentence report is waived. I have not had an opportunity to see the language proposed, other than just having heard it, the language, Mr. Watson's language, but I would hesitate to require any further specific findings about aggravation and mitigation by the trial court. The trial court, under existing law, is required to state the reasons for the sentence imposed, and the judge at that point can state, in imposing the sentence, the reasons why he thinks that this is a particularly aggravated or one in which the sentence perhaps is one less than he would normally impose. I think it can probably be handled that way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on the proposed amendment. Is there objection to the proposed amendment? Not a passage. Your motion on the bill is amended.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that House Bill 2299 be sent to the floor of the House. They did pass that committee.
Mr. Chairman, move to approve the House Bill 2299 as amended. Be sent to the floor of the House. They did pass that committee. Discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Councilman Davis?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Frohnmeyer?
No.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richard?
No.
Smith?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes. Okay, the next thing we'll take up is House Bill 2295.
Dennis is handing around a proposal by Judge Gilbert.
Possession and the question of sale. And what we're doing here is we're giving the opportunity to reduce the judgment in one case and not in the other. And I think that they were tied to both heroin and marijuana with respect to that. And this is just an effort to break out the marijuana. And Joe would have to explain exactly what we're talking about here in
475.992. 475.992 is the penalty section for possession of controlled substances. Paragraph A of subsection 4 of 475.992 is controlled substances in Schedule 1. And at the moment, and for the foreseeable future, marijuana is Schedule 1 controlled substance. So the bill, the way it's drafted, makes selling marijuana reducible, but it does not make possession of more than an ounce of marijuana reducible. So the proposed amendment would allow the court to reduce the possession of marijuana only. It wouldn't affect other Schedule 1 substances.
Lift out marijuana from the Schedule 1 heroin and brings possession along with sale.
Okay. Representative Cohen?
Sure. I'll move that amendment.
Okay, Representative Cohen has moved that House Bill 2295 be amended by the amendment distributed to you dated 3179, House Bill 2295, proposed amendment. Discussion.
John, Representative Rutherford, law prior to the Controlled Substances Act provided that possession was reducible.
Yeah. Further discussion on the proposed amendment?
I'm a little confused. Did this include selling as a reducible
Yeah, the amendment does not, but the bill itself receives selling.
I think that's accurate,
represents you just okay. So you can reduce, as the law stands now, you can reduce the sentence selling, but not the possession.
That's correct.
And this makes the lesser crime.
Well, at present, represents you just notwithstanding the bill, the sale of marijuana is not reducible, as is any other class of felony other than, with one exception to that.
Well, the mistake that happened in the Controlled Substances Act was that because of the deletion of the word or, Class B felonies and Class B felonies other than drugs, other than certain drug ones, were no longer able to be reduced. That includes selling of marijuana. The bill was designed to rectify that situation, which everybody has believed it's a bad situation, but it's just a plain mistake. But the bill as drafted only applies to sale, it doesn't apply to possession of marijuana. So if the bill was passed, you could reduce sale, but you couldn't reduce possession.
Okay, is there further discussion on the proposed amendment? Is there objection to the proposed amendment? Did you object? If not, it's adopted. Okay, we'll take up the next amendment, which is Jesse Gelder.
Amendment. Jones, do you want to explain this? Okay, as I understand it, Judge Gilbert's concern is that the bill is overly broad in Section 2. In that it would allow defendants to move for reconsideration in situations in which the court had the option initially to consider misdemeanor treatment and decided not to do it. So this is the first time I've seen this proposed amendment, but I gather that the intent of it is to narrow the application only to those situations in which the judge didn't have the option of reducing it to a Class A misdemeanor because of the mistake in the bill last session. So his proposed language is in the middle of page 1 of his letter.
Well, my question is, the language in Section 2, does the language in Section 2 expand the law as it was at the time that the Controlled Substances Act was passed?
No, it doesn't.
Okay. How does that differ from the language in Judge Shelter's letter? How does he know the application of the law in his letter? Did this remove the Class B felony?
Now, I think that the heart of his proposed amendment is of any Class B felony which at the time of conviction was not subject to possible misdemeanor treatment. To specify that they're only talking about a certain category of cases, but I don't know, I'm not exactly sure what problem it is that he's trying to solve, since this is not an expansion of the law prior to the Controlled Substances Act. Maybe Judge Beatty knows.
Judge Beatty, you had some comments regarding the bill that's come forward.
John Beatty, representing the Judicial Conference. I have a copy of Judge Gelker's letter. Frankly, Mr. Chairman, looking at what happened in the Control of Substance Act, I'm not exactly sure how that differs from Section 2 of the bill, except that it may relate to another thing that I'm concerned about. That is that prior to the passing of the act in the last session, any Class B felony involving drugs and any Class C felony could be handled by the sentencing court with a felony misdemeanor option. And that option could be exercised either at the time of initially imposing sentence, or if the court placed an individual on probation and thus retained jurisdiction over him, he could reserve the exercise of that option until the end of the sentence of probation was successfully served. And then at that time, if it was served successfully, the court would treat it as a misdemeanor. And I think that to some extent that may be involved in Judge Jelker's concern here. I would be concerned with not having that option. It seems to me that it is advantageous to have a defendant, particularly someone who has had some prior records, to say, look, this time you have either got to successfully serve your period of probation or you're going to be facing, this will be a felony conviction. And if you do serve it successfully, you have an opportunity of having produced to a class A misdemeanor. So I would like to see language added to Section 2, which in substance would say the court may likewise, in its discretion, reduce such felony convictions to a Class A misdemeanor upon successful completion of probation. But I cannot be certain that that includes everything that Judge Yelker is concerned with in his language. I'd be happy to try to reach him on the telephone.
I'd be favorable toward that because I think it's a little bit confusing. We don't really have his intent. Can we set this file aside for a few minutes and get a little feedback on it and come back to it?
There's no objection to that. That will be what we should do. If you could contact him and perhaps work with him as far as bringing back some language for Section 2, we'd appreciate it. Okay, we'll move now to House Bill 2063.
Mr. Chairman, I've got some amendments and some other material to hand over here. For each one of these persons who didn't know, we have a little bit of handout. But they should go pretty soon. Statutory section 423.027 makes a reference to a unit of the Corrections Division which properly doesn't exist anymore under the term Adult Community Services Unit. So the Corrections Division came in and asked for an amendment of the statute to clarify that misnomer. At the time the subcommittee considered the bill, it became clear that if you left the bill intact, it would still be a little bit misleading because 423.027 wouldn't fit correctly with 423.020, the preceding section, which you can see on the page that I gave out to you. So there, the subcommittee did recommend that this bill pass, but it also recommended some amendments to make the statute flow a little bit more smoothly. And I'll read those to you. In line 2 of the printed bill, after 423.027, insert this up in the relating clause, and repealing 423.030. The point there is that 030 is surplusage and doesn't add anything to the series of statutory sections at all. And legislative counsel, when I consulted Kathleen Buffet, recommended that that just be dropped. So that's the first proposed amendment. The next one would be in line 6, after the word division, referring to Corrections Division, there would be an insertion of the words with respect to parole, probation, and other forms of relief, so that the sentence would read, among the duties and functions of the Corrections Division, with respect to parole, probation, and other forms of relief, are, colon, and there's a list of functions. And the third proposed amendment from the subcommittee would be that after the end of the bill, after line 25, there'd be a new section inserted, section 2, ORS 423 point, as the mixture, but it should be 030 is repealed. So that's the subcommittee's report and recommendation.
Question. Go. 423-030, as I read it, basically just says that it's kind of a general clause, says that any powers that aren't enumerated that they need to have, they have. Okay.
Well,
is that, aren't we perhaps dealing with a sleeping dog, and might there not be something that we haven't added in 020 that, or somewhere else in the ORS, some powers that they may need?
Well, that's not exactly what it says, and the reason, the difference between what you said and what I think it says gives you your answer. That is, this simply says that the list above is not exclusive nor intended as a limitation. Well, if it's not exclusive, there have to be powers enumerated in other places. And if there are no other powers enumerated anyplace else, 030 doesn't add anything. If there are powers enumerated elsewhere, 030 still doesn't add anything. No matter how you cut it, it just doesn't add anything.
Okay.
So that's what the subcommittee tells.
Okay, the amendments are before you. Is there a motion on the amendment? This is moved that House Bill 2063 be amended by the amendments distributed to the members dated House Bill 2063, amendments proposed 2979, revised 2279. Discussion. Objection. Hearing none, adopted. The motion of the bill is amended.
Move it forward. Two pass for the minutes.
Listener Judas has moved that House Bill 2063 as amended be sent to floor for due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Richards.
Mr. Chairman, this may not be the bill, but I thought I recalled in line 16 there was some concern that it might be overly narrow if we were to confine the language to the Assistant Director for Corrections.
Maybe Kip has the answer, but that's right. This is the bill, and we discussed that, and it's my opinion, at least, that the assistant director being invested with these powers could in turn delegate to any person under his employment to carry them out, and therefore it's not restricted.
I think that was, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that is also the gist of the testimony in response to my question to the Corrections Division, and so I felt satisfied at that point that the authority was already there to delegate, and consequently we could stand with that language.
Mr.
Chairman, with reference to that same line 16, it talks about general policies established by the assistant director, as though that were something different than the adoption and enforcement of rules necessary for the administration of the services. What that may be doing inadvertently is imposing two rulemaking proceedings where one would think that only one was necessary, because when you talk about general policies established, you talk about something that falls within the definition of rule under the Administrative Procedure Act. It seems to me that the Corrections Division does not want is to have the assistant director make policies by rule, only to have to go down and then have the division, whoever it is here, Corrections Division, make more rules that essentially repeat those policies verbatim.
That wasn't something that the subcommittee thought about.
I'm not trying to be hyper-technical in the reading mode, except that a literal reading of this section, which granted is existing law, could be construed to mean that two rulemaking proceedings, one where the assistant director sets down general policies, and the second where they adopt specific rules relating to the enforcement of those policies.
I would think that line 16 is basically all the way along, surplus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems to me you want them to adopt and enforce the rules, or you want them to adopt the rules which embody the agency policy right then and there.
Mr. Chairman, you could delete everything after the numeral 4 on line 16 and then line 17 and insert the word 2 for parallel construction so that each one of the subsections starts with word 2 and then a verb. To make investigation, to keep record, and to adopt and enforce.
Okay,
so the taking the conceptual amendment or the concept represented somewhere throughout, in line 16, after the numeral 4 in parentheses, you would delete the entire line and insert the word 2 so that the subsection would read 4, to adopt and enforce rules necessary, etc.
Okay,
rip
this one
now. That satisfies me. Now, we haven't heard from the folks that have to do it in the trenches. But it seems to me it gives you some greater flexibility in terms of sub-delegating authority without taking away the overall responsibility of your agency.
I agree with the amendment. I think the reason was really the way it was that there was a separate section called Field Services that did adopt procedures after the overall rules of the policy and the divisions that adopted and how far necessary.
Okay, so you're seeing in favor of that amendment?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative, do you want to withdraw?
I'll withdraw.
Okay, Representative Frohmeyer moves that line 16 of the bill be deleted, and before the word adopt in line 17, that we insert the word 2 with a subsection 4 following that. Discussion on the amendment. Objection to the amendment, and then it's adopted. Okay, let's confuse this.
Move as far as too fast as a minute. Give it another try.
Representative Judas moves that House Bill 2063 as amended be sent before the due pass recommendation. Further discussion. Okay, if not, please call the roll.
Judas?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Frohmeyer?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richard?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes. Okay, now we'll take up House Bill 2067.
Okay. I'm going to pass it out, but while I'll describe this. This bill before you would explicitly add to the conditions which may be required of a probationer, residence in a halfway house or a community correction center or probation center. And the amendment I'm passing out is very minor. It's over on page 3. There's a reference to a specific subsection under chapter 183. And when I consulted the legislative council, they urged me to change that specific reference to a more general reference to chapter 183, but otherwise the subcommittee had no amendment of the bill recommended to amendment. It just recommended that you send this for due pass as amended with this one small amendment.
And on line 17, I don't see anywhere else, Mr. Chairman. That's it.
Right here, yeah. 183, chapter 183. Okay, the chair would move that the bill be amended on page 3 of the printed bill by, in line 17, deleting 183.335 and inserting chapter 183. So it reads, provisions of RF chapter 183. Discussion on the amendment. Objection to the amendment. Say that is adopted. The motion of the bill is amended.
I have a question on the bill.
Let's go to
line 27, page 3, adds the word corrections in between community and center. Am I to take it from that it used to read community centers?
Yes.
Now, are there things that community centers do that community correction centers don't, such that we would be narrowing the scope of things that the division can do?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Watson?
Chairman, Representative Frohmeyer, it wasn't our intent. That's just the standard language we use to refer to work release centers and probation centers, community correction centers. This is the in noting that change that wasn't used in the statute, so that's the only
very minor question, though. I mean, do you maintain things called centers that might be other than work release centers?
No, we don't.
So this is the only thing you've got.
Before you leave, Mr. Chairman, this contemplates a sentence by the court, right?
Yeah.
The modified section you're talking about. Does this allow the court to be passed as to then make provisions that a person found appropriately qualified and where the situation is necessary to put them into a house like the beginning first stage treatment centers?
Yes, it would.
Such as the Phoenix, huh?
Yes.
The way the court might perceive, but typically what you're getting at.
That's right. Community. So they can put them direct in without sending them to jail and then have them come out of jail, take them.
Okay. Representative Richard?
Mr. Watson, could you refresh my memory about the policing of language in lines 14 and 15, page 3 of the bill written to Senator Crowley?
This is adopted under a joint rule now between the parole board and the corrections division in AP adopted rules now. Subcommittee asked me about the need to include written consent, and it's really a superfluous language because every person wants to get into one of those centers instead of go to jail or go to prison, and we've got really a lot of coercive power, as I recall my words, to get anything in writing we want from an individual who's in that circumstance. So it's in the rule now, and we intend to keep it there, and I would not be opposed to having it in the law, but it just isn't necessary.
Further questions? Representative Bugis?
Move the bill as well to pass as amended.
Okay, Representative Bugis moves House Bill 2067 to amend the 4th to pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Romine?
I think the focus is for consent calendars, for him.
And to be placed on the consent calendar. That's part of your motion, excuse
yes.
me. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bugis? Aye.
Cohen? Jeremiah?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richard?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Pass. And we'll now take up House Bill 2069.
Okay, just some more amendments.
Okay.
This bill would affect some housekeeping and cleanup by changes in the Community Corrections Act. The Community Corrections Act, as you may recall, was a comprehensive bill enacted last session to authorize and fund retention of less serious criminal offenders in the community, and the Corrections Division has been operating under it now for about a year or a year and a half, and has found a need for certain changes, and the changes are embodied in the bill before you and also the proposed rule. I'll take you through the proposed amendments. I'll take you through them one by one. But just to start to summarize, the bill itself is a cleanup type of bill. First, in line 2 of the printed bill, after ORS would be inserted the numerals 423.500 and 423.530, so that the bill would subsequently amend two statutory sections instead of one. The one that's included, the 500 section, is a definitional section, and if you'll drop down to the bottom of the page, you'll see 500 set out in full, and the amendment that's proposed is the deletion of subsection 3, which is the definition of county. At the present time, and since the beginning of operation under the Act, a county had to have more than 30,000 people in it to apply for community corrections funding. And if it didn't have that many people, it would have to combine with another county to have a joint program. Experience has taught the Corrections Division that it's preferable to have certain counties, there are two or three of them around the state,
let them come into the act, even though they haven't got enough people to meet the standard, and they there's no sign that they can easily join them. This would expand the coverage of the act, that deletion of the word county. Second amendment would be, in line 14, delete the words prior to October 1st, 1977, and. The reason for that is obviously that we're now beyond 1977 and there's no further need for that language in the statute. In line 15, the word thereafter would be deleted. Again, that's just a language change to clean it up. In line 16, there'd be a more substantive change. If you read line 16 through 19, you'll see that there is set out in the statute a standard for determining formula so that counties may share in the funds made available by the legislature. Right now, that formula refers to a share of the unduplicated number of persons charged in justice, district, or circuit court with felonies during the most recent calendar years as certified by the state court administrator. That's a pretty technical and hard set of data. Only problem is that the state court administrator wasn't able to provide that data so that when the corrections division went to use the statute, they couldn't use it. They had to get an attorney general's opinion to authorize the use of comparable but not quite the same data. And so they came in before us and proposed the following language. Shall be based upon statewide crime and demographic data certified by a state agency other than the corrections division. It's more general. It allows them to go to the employment division to get unemployment checkers. It allows them to go to Portland State University to get population data, risk population data, and in general, the kind of data that they say they need to arrive at a formula for distributing the funds. I'll continue. You would delete lines 17 through 19, which is the existing language. Down in line 20, after the word charge, each participating county shall be assessed a charge. There would be inserted the words of $3,000. The point there is that to the extent that a county comes into the Community Corrections Act and still sends felony offenders to the penitentiary, the county has to hand back to the state a certain portion of the funds that were given to the county to keep people at home. It's an incentive to keep people at home. And the $3,000 figure arrived at represents the incremental additional cost of including one more person in the penitentiary. So if they're going to send one more person to Salem, they have to send $3,000 with them to pay for his maintenance. There's a ceiling on that, though, and that's the bold print in the bill. No county would be required to send back to the Corrections Division anything more than the ceiling figure of $3,000 on the felon or the total amount of the grant that the county got to enable it to participate. So it wouldn't cost the county any money over and above what it had already received from the state. And it's not anticipated that the county would be sending so many people to the penitentiary that they'd have to hand back all the money. There's one other, the deletion of line 25 is perfunctory.
Okay, to approve the amendment in point, the chair would move the adoption of the amendment dated February 9, 1979, House Bill 269, proposed amendment. Discussion.
Where did these amendments come
from? These amendments were worked out in subcommittee, and I would say all of them were first proposed, at least conceptually, by the Corrections Division. It's the Corrections Division's bill, and it's their amendment.
I would say, before I recognize Representative Smith, that I had some concerns about what statewide crime and demographic data certified by a state agency other than the Corrections Division meant, and why we were moving from the standard that's presently in the bill. I guess the answer to that is that the standard that's in the bill is not available, and that I believe it was the Attorney General basically said that the money that was appropriated by the 77 legislature would have to be distributed upon a different basis than that. I have some concern about what crime and demographic data they're going to use. At this point, there isn't a standard that comes directly to mind that we can at that point.
I just want to point out, Mr. Chairman, that Dennis, you omitted at the end of your summary of the amendment to add the new section 2. I think you mentioned at the outset, but we are adding all of the language.
That's correct. Yeah, I didn't go back over that.
Yeah, again. Okay.
Further discussion on the proposed amendment. Your objection to the proposed amendment is not adopted. Motion on the bill is amended. Representative Lombard. Representative Lombard moves Council 2069 as amended to be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Engrossed.
Okay, that's part of the motion. The further discussion.
Yes.
Representative Aiden.
Maybe it's the correction decision that I have. Something about this bothers me. I don't know where these numbers come from, this, how they get 3,000. I just get this,
Mr. Chairman, go ahead.
Yeah.
Bob can answer that, but let me see how much I can remember the testimony. The counties need to have a set figure for budgeting purposes. And because they need to set aside a contingency fund, which represents the money they conceivably might have to refund to the state. And they didn't have a figure, and they said they needed one. 3,000 is a figure that has some basis in reality because it's the cost to the Corrections Division of incarcerating one more person in a prison that's already there. That's not to say that it costs only $3,000 a year to incarcerate the average person. Costs quite a bit more. I think it's maybe as much as 11,000. But to add one more person on top of the pile costs about 3,000 additional dollars. Now, if you insert 3,000 or any other figure, you give the county some certainty, and then they know they can multiply it up by the number of people they think will be covered by the act, and then they have the ability to put their budgets together. That's the explanation we have.
Fiscal impact here, then.
Doesn't the bill have a...
The fiscal impact is beneficial.
There's a lot of contingency money being set aside, and this helps reduce the amount of contingency in it.
Chairman, Representative Mason, the amended $3,000 figure is included in the governor's budget. It's assumed that this bill would pass, so there's no referral necessary to Ways and Means. If it doesn't pass, then there's several million dollars short in the governor's budget that would have to be looked at again.
But it's contingent money, right?
That's right. What it does, if this bill doesn't pass, it'll reduce the amount of money available to the counties by about $5 million. What this does is set aside money for repay. If you reduce the repay, then there's more money available to the counties. So that's the county's wish that we make this amendment. It's the primary reason several counties didn't come in. They saw the forcing to pay the state for Class C commitments was just objectionable. They wanted the charge eliminated. Some counties felt it should be eliminated. Others felt it could be reduced or made the certainty with a ceiling, then they could plan appropriately and be able to participate in the act.
Further questions on the motion? The motion is to send House Bill 2069 as amended to the floor to due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Commissioner Dugas?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes. And that will take up House Bill 2020.
Chairman, House Bill 2020 is an interstate compact bill. It's a bill adopted by, at the present time, 20 of 50 states. The amendment in this bill has been adopted by 20 of 50 states. And the amendment would allow extradition. It's over on page 6. And it would allow extradition from one state to the next of children alleged to be delinquent. So, child could be picked up in California and under this section sent up to Oregon, or picked up in Oregon sent down to California. As the case may be, there are two small amendments proposed by the subcommittee. The first is, for clarity's sake, over on page 2 of the bill, where the reference to child without specifying what child. It's pretty clear what child they're referring to, but the amendment would say child described as subsection 1 of this section for greater clarity. The other amendment that is proposed to the bill is on page 4, line 23. If numeral 90 would be deleted and 30 inserted, so that the temporary hold allowed under the interstate contact of 90 days would be reduced to 30 days. When the subcommittee considered that change, did it?
Line 28, I think.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
These things were typed up in a hurry. And the subcommittee instructed me to ask the people concerned whether that reduction from 90 to 30 days would work any hardship, whether it be on the prosecution or the corrections division, not corrections, but the juvenile corrections authority, or anybody else concerned. And I did that survey, and everybody agreed that 30 would be fine, because in most cases the hold is actually about 1 to 7 days. You'll notice that the subcommittee didn't recommend any change whatsoever in the heart of the bill over on page 6. They just recommended that be sent to the floor with a due pass.
Okay, Representative Dugas moves the House Bill 2020 be amended by the amendments distributed to you by staff entitled March 5th, 1979, House Bill 2020, proposed amendment. Amendment. Discussion. Objection. Hearing that it's ordered.
Move the chairman.
Representative Lombard.
Dennis, I just discovered something here that I guess you didn't say in subsequently, at least it right off hand doesn't appear to make much sense. The section 2 of the bill says OS 419.591 is added to and made a part of 419.472 to 419.590. Where's 419.591? Is that it? Unless section 2 is to be called 419.591, and if section 2 is to be called 419.591, then don't we already take care of that up under section 1?
Well, how about if I find a proper way for that to be worded to make sense, and we proceed with the bill anyway? Because that's obviously some sort of a typo.
First of all, sir, what's your pleasure at this point?
I think it looks to me like we take section 3 out of there.
How about if you instruct me to check with legislative council since they put it together and ask them? See, that's an instruction to them anyway. Ask them how they want to instruct it.
Yeah. Can we condition a motion, a Dupas motion, Dupas amended motion, subject to being further amended by striking section 3 or amending section 3 in accordance with the council's recommendation to you? That's my motion.
Okay. Representative Lombard has moved that House Bill 2020 be sent to the floor for Dupas recommendation. contingent upon Section 3 being clarified, and it's stated that way. Discussion. Not the clerk to call the roll.
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richard?
No.
Jester?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Gardner? Aye. Pass. Okay. Let's take up Council 2011. This has always been a point where we've gotten stuck before, and perhaps as the one, I'll be happy to sit with my committee. This is the last chance. If it doesn't come out, it's going to be tabled. This is the first one, one way or another today.
Okay, this is the second redraft of House Bill 2011. The original purpose of the bill, for those of you who are not on Subcommittee 2, was to clarify access to the records. The general provision of the bill is that after a public record is 25 years old, it will be available for inspection. There are, in Section 3, four exceptions. Records containing medical information about a living person will be exempt for 75 years. Records that are sealed by a court order also will be exempt from disclosure for 75 years. Records of the person in custody and student records. Student records will be exempt as long as they're required by federal or state law to be exempt. That's the Buckley Amendment, which we had in another bill. Subsection 3, first of all, the last thing that Subcommittee 2 got hung up on was Subsection 2 of Section 3, which is records sealed by a court order. I got a computer printout from Legislative Council in which I discovered the limits of computers. As I checked 55 statutes having to do with sealed, open, and court, and county roads, and the county clerk putting a seal on a document, and so on, there is no general statute pertaining to sealing of court records or opening of records that were sealed by a court. There are several pertinent statutes, but the language is not similar. So there's no standard language. So the language that we came up with is such records may be disclosed upon order of a court of competent jurisdiction or as otherwise provided by law. Now, the subcommittee recommends that the bill in this form pass. However, subsection 3 is now presenting a slight problem as it's currently drafted to the corrections division because they don't want people's records to be open as soon as the person goes off parole or gets out of the institution or something. So Mr. Porter and the corrections people who are here have suggested an amendment to subsection 3, which would be to delete records of and insert files containing an entry less than 75 years old pertaining to. And then I suggested after person, just to make it consistent, you put in who is or has been in the custody, etc., so that the sentence would read, files containing an entry less than 75 years old pertaining to a person who is or has been in the custody or under the lawful supervision of a state agency, a court, or a unit of local government, etc. That way, a file of a person who has been in custody would not be opened up under this bill until 75 years after the last event contained in the file. So it would make it consistent with subsections 1 and 2 on 75 years.
I have a question at this point. Reading subsection 2 of the bill, it says that a That's the general provision.
Right.
Okay, so what we're really talking about is that for someone to come under Section 3, as it's personally worded, that's in the correction provision situation, the record itself about them would have to be 25 years of old, and they would also have to be off probation or parole. Is that accurate?
As it's currently worded, as it's currently worded, records of a person in custody are exempt from disclosure, but as soon as he is no longer in custody or under supervision, I don't think that he's come back into Section 2. I think that that's the exception for during the time of custody or under supervision. And that the way it's worded now, as soon as the supervision ends, the records would become available.
What's the present law regarding each one?
The wording now in 192.500 is pretty much the way it is in the current subsection 3. They're exempt from disclosure to the extent that disclosure is refusal to rehabilitation of the person in custody and so on. Except that the way that's being defined currently, according to Mr. Porter, is that they're exempt from disclosure, period. And the person has an affirmative burden of proving the public interest.
Well,
gives them the right to see the record.
Is the language identical to the present language in Section 4F192.500
yes.
Or Subsection 3 in concern?
The language starting with
records
to the extent the text is the
it's
language
identical.
Of the text is identical to 192.500.
Okay. Well, let's take this in two parts. First, the chair would move the adoption of the amendment presented to us, entitled House Bill 2011, Second Redraft, 22279.
Then this raises a question that we're addressing, of course, in a couple of other bills for this committee, interpreting Section 2, where it says, notwithstanding ORS 192.500, and except for Section 3 of the Act. First of all, are adoption records considered public records? And if they are, and they're covered under 192.500, which I believe they are, would this allow the opening up of adoption records after 25 years?
Adoption records are sealed by court order, I believe, and therefore they would fall under subsection 2 of section 3 of the bill. So that until they were 75 years old, they could not be disclosed except upon order of the court.
Further discussion on the motion. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's adopted. Okay. Is there a motion in relation to the correction to the issue proposed amendment? Is there a motion on the bill as amended?
Mr. Chairman?
What's this said?
I realize that no motion was just placed on the correction provision language, but I understood all of what they were going to do, but I don't understand the policy fully behind the need for it.
For the amendment?
Yes.
They're concerned that the way the bill is worded now, they would have to make records public as soon as somebody came off parole. And perhaps they want to keep, it's a policy decision for the committee whether you want the records potentially opened at that point or whether you want to wait.
Well, and I guess I'm asking what the negatives are of having that be the case. A person comes out off parole, why shouldn't their records be available to the public?
I assume Mr. Chambers
is coming in.
Executive Assistant, Corrections Division. As we understand the bill, Mr. Chairman, the records of any individual would be open once 25 years had passed and the individual was no longer within any restitution. Take the case of a person who is convicted of a crime requiring 50 years confinement. After 27 years, the individual is granted parole. On the day the individual is granted parole, as the law is presently worded, the first 2 years of that person's records would be available to the public, although the individual is still under our supervision. Each day thereafter, one more day's worth of records would be opened. We don't believe it is appropriate that records of a person under our supervision be opened to the general public during the time or immediately after the time of that supervision. We think the individual has a right to a reasonable degree of privacy while under supervision, and certainly at least for a period of time after that supervision has been concluded and the individual is returned to private life.
In the example you gave, I don't think that that's the case, because it says the records that they're not, they are exempt from disclosure. It says records of a person in custody or under the law supervision. So he was sentenced to 50 years and served 25 and then was placed on parole.
The original wording would have done as I'm indicating. The first redraft, as I understand it, has corrected that to the extent that the individual would be protected during the time of supervision, but wouldn't open the records immediately upon termination of supervision. And we feel that it's appropriate that the person be permitted some degree of private life during a period of readjustment.
My second question is, this language is almost identical to the language that's in the present law. And if there's a problem, is there a problem with the present law and how that's being administered?
Our concern is that the bill was brought forward. We felt that as originally presented, it would open records that we didn't feel should be opened. We felt the original wording was better. However, Mr. Porter, for a variety of reasons, from Archive's point of view, feels it's appropriate to do some clarification. We have no specific concern about the wording as long as our client's records are protected for a reasonable period of time.
Have you seen the second redraft, this piece of paper?
We just glanced at it a few minutes ago, and it looks quite acceptable to us, so we've not had a chance to sit and study it.
Is it acceptable to you?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Longworth.
Let me ask a question with regards to subparagraph C, and there I see we have a variable in there to the extent that disclosure thereof would interfere with the rehabilitation of the person in custody if the public interest in confidentiality clearly outweighs the public interest in disclosure. Who makes that determination? The court or the corrections division? Corrections division.
That presumably be reviewable as a non-contested case order then by the court.
Okay, and that's present language. Is there further discussion on the motion? Motion is to send House Bill 2011 as amended to the floor with the D-PAS recommendation. Clerk, call the roll. Clinton and Grove.
Representative
Dugan?
Aye.
Cohen?
No.
Jeremiah? Aye. Lombard? Aye. Mason?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Gargan?
Aye.
Pass. Mr. Chairman, yeah, could you take up this 2063 again so that you could put it on the consent calendar? So, language change.
Representative Somar moves that the House Bill 2063 be put on the consent calendar. Is there discussion? Is there objection? So ordered.
Okay. Mr. Beatty is back.
I was unable to reach Jeff Gelker. The telephone line up there is busy, but I think I
I think I understand what he had in mind, and I think I can suggest language that will substantially accomplish it. I'd be happy to keep on telephoning, but we don't seem to be able to get through.
Well, if you have some language, I think the committee would be willing at this point to look to. We'll return now to House Bill 2295.
Mr. Chairman, I fully concur with your legal counsel that it's possible the net result are some sentences which are so long they're kind of appalling, but short of redrafting the entire bill, why this is the language I would suggest. In line 10, after the period, insert the following language. The court may likewise, in its discretion, reduce such felony convictions to a...
down there for a minute.
I'm sorry. Reduce such felony convictions to a Class A misdemeanor upon successful completion of a sentence of probation. Period. Line 17. After the word act, insert the following. Which felony was not subject to possible misdemeanor treatment at the time of sentence, comma, line 17, after the word court, insert the following.
Wait a second. Okay, after sentencing
word
court.
Sentencing court. Within 5 years of the date of imposition of sentence, the first proposed amendment simply restores the, makes it clear that the sentencing court can defer exercising this option until completion of probation, which is what we had before the inadvertent error in the amendment last session. Second, the second proposed amendment eliminates making this act retroactive and applicable to a person who, where the option was still preserved, which was, I believe, the amendment of the Controlled Substances Act left a Class C drug, certain Class C drug offense subject to possible misdemeanor treatment, and this just doesn't create a second bite at the apple as to that one. The third amendment will put a period to the period of time in which this matter can be raised, and rather than cutting it off in 1980, as Judge Gelford suggests, I thought it might be best to just run it to a possible period of probation, because almost anyone almost any defendant where a judge would consider exercising such a discretion would have been placed on probation, and the judge would have that file before him for up to a maximum of 5 years. And that concludes the suggested amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I'm really uncomfortable taking action on this bill this afternoon in light of this changes the thrust of the whole bill. And what I would recommend to the committee, Mr. Chairman, is that the amendments be drafted up, that a copy of them be sent to Judge Gelder, to the public defender, to Mr. Foss, the District Attorney Association, and the Attorney General, because this really is, I think, a significant new direction. I'm really reluctant to take action this afternoon on a change of the significance without getting the relevant parties to comment on it.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, with all due respect for Representative Fromeyer, I don't see why it is a change in direction.
Well, I'm not sure that it is, Representative Mason, but we can avoid a special session sometimes by taking a little bit more time massaging the bill to make sure that it does what we want it to do. And simply precautionary means not dilatory for any given purpose. I just want to know what it means.
Mr. Chairman.
I think I would agree with Representative Mason. I don't think it really substantially changes the direction of the bill. However, the existing sentence has 75 words in it. I didn't count the number of words that we're adding. I'm just wondering if counsel can take a shot at making the whole paragraph a little shorter and more understandable.
Well,
if I may comment, Mr. Chairman, I concur entirely. I think there ought to be a presumption against sentences that long, and
I'd be happy. You mean language type
thing? As I recall, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fromeyer last session, I think, put a limit of 90 words per sentence. He voted against everything over that. It's my recollection.
I think we could
reduce that this session.
Well, I'm not so concerned about getting the Attorney General's opinion or the District Attorney's opinion on the bill, but I would like to see it in front of me all in one piece with an opportunity to check the statutory references so to see that it makes sense. So at least to that extent, if we can have that amendment printed up and perhaps have the whole bill typed as it would appear, and it wouldn't hurt at that point, since we're going to do that, to send it to those parties and allow them some time until our next work session, at least, to comment if they so wish. Okay. That will be Representative Rutherford.
I think there was some other people who testified on the bill that probably would appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone signed up that would have an interest, send them a copy of the proposed language. Okay.
We move to 2295. Well, Senate 273.
2073 and 2017 are about equally difficult enough. So they just take a little bit of reading, that's all. But you can get through them straight away.
Okay, let's pick up 2073.
Mr. Chairman, this is the jail standard bill, and this is a bill that was put together by a task force of parties concerned with standards in local correctional facilities, jails, lockups, and temporary holds. And the bill was the subject of extensive work and revision in the subcommittee, and I've got some fairly extensive revisions to it proposed by the subcommittee. I'm going to pass out. Section of 169.075, which would be repealed and replaced by this bill. we set standards for local correctional facilities. The standards set out in that section, which would be repealed, are very summary and brief, and those standards serve as the starting point for this bill. But this bill expands on those quite a bit. The bill has sort of a split function, kind of interesting. On the one hand, it would serve to set out more explicitly the requirements that would have to be met for a legal local correctional facility, and tend to protect prisoners' rights, people who are confined in these kinds of facilities. On the other hand, by setting out with this degree of specificity, which we understand is for the most part met by the various counties around the state, it wouldn't necessarily change very much of the existing practice, and would, in contrast, make it more difficult for a prisoner to successfully win a legal proceeding against the conditions that exist in the facility that he was in, because there would be a sort of a tendency in a reviewing court to look at a statute that was this specific and see that if all of these conditions were met, then there would be a presumption that the facility was running properly. So it goes two directions at the same time. I consulted with a number of prisoners' rights organizations, and they weren't wildly enthusiastic about it, but they did see that the standards that were set out seemed to be good standards. So that's background. The whole set of proposed amendments, I'll take you through them. On page 2 of the printed bill, line 28, there, after the numeral 169.080, there'd be the insertion of a subsection 1 number, so that 080 would be thereafter split into two subsections. In the same line, after the second dot, you would insert the word A, and in the same line after facility, insert lockup, so that would be the section would refer to local correctional facilities and lockup. As you can see now, it just refers to local correctional facilities. 080 in general requires that the Corrections Division make its advisory expertise available to counties and locales that are considering, I'm jumping ahead a little bit. 080 requires the Corrections Division to get involved in monitoring for compliance with the standards of the bill. And the proposed amendment would get the Corrections Division involved in monitoring in lockups as well as local correctional facilities. It'd be an expansion of there.
Dennis, the language of the proposed amendment in line 34, sub 2, it allows the Attorney General to bring suit at the request of the Corrections Division. Does that preclude the Attorney General bringing suit on his or her own behalf? Before looking to address the administrative mechanism contemplated by this section, does it mean that the Corrections Division essentially has to okay it? Or could the Attorney General go off on the Attorney General's own?
The bill as proposed and as the amendment proposed would anticipate the Corrections Division's jail inspection team going out, finding a condition that which needed remedy, and coming back to the Attorney General and saying, we've got one, we want you to go to court on it, because we haven't been able to resolve it through negotiation. So it would anticipate the Corrections Division taking the first step.
Well, is it your view then that the Attorney General is powerless to act until requested to act by the Corrections Division?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the understanding of members who serve on the subcommittee that heard this bill?
Yes.
Questions of the committee on sections 1, 2, and 3?
Okay.
Excuse me, Mr. Watson, do you have any observations there? Okay.
I might add that this was also the recommendation of the Bars Committee on Detention and Corrections, of which I was a member.
and the exact language in there was that the Attorney General, at the request of the Corrections Division, may bring suit or action and may seek declaratory judgment, etc. I think it was basically a statement that the Corrections Division would be the initiating agency in this respect, because it was the agency initially required to discover, to do the investigation, and then use the Attorney General's office to bring corrective action.
Okay. The next section 4 amends 159.085. 085 is the section which gets the Corrections Division involved whenever a county or other local body of government plans the construction or major renovation of a local correctional facility. And the subcommittee recommended that in addition to local correctional facilities, lockups should be included there, so that you see on line 37 after facilities, the proposal that would the words "and lockup" should be inserted. That's it for section 4 as far as amendments go.
And if I want to go back to the language that on line 34, the addition, and apparently this is new language with respect to nothing in this section shall preclude a private right of suit or action.
Right.
Take it using the word suit and action, because you may contemplate an injunction in equity or some, what, damages action?
Yes.
All right. Do you think that such a right of action exists now? No, I know that it's viewed under federal law, under section 1983, but we're here speaking about a state law today.
It might be better suited to answer that question. The only answer I can give you is that when I've dealt with the Bar Committee on this bill, they've referred to both the action for damages and injunctive relief as being the kinds of things that prisoners would sue for. But I never carried the research on it any further than that. And Kit might have more.
It's possible here we're creating new sorts of liability on behalf of the state or local government, I presume.
It's not intended to.
Well, if we say nothing precludes it, don't we by implication say that it exists?
Yes. And my understanding is that it said it already existed, but I didn't research that.
Well, section 1983 suits would exist in federal court, but one other question. If you have such a right exists, I suppose, to sue at the local level under state law, there's no condition preceding that a private person goes to the Corrections Division.
Right.
They don't have the
they don't have to wait for the challenge.
The yellow light of the Corrections Division.
That's right.
Okay. Give us the Bar position.
Well, my recollection is that there would be certain conditions, certain treatments today for which an individual would have a private right of action or suit.
This bill is not, is this bill designed either to
I don't believe that it was either our intent or really even contemplation that we were creating something new that did not already exist.
But if it did not exist, this bill would not confer that right, would it?
I quite frankly don't recall that we even discussed it in the context of trying to create a right that didn't exist. I don't think that issue was before the committee. That is the issue of creating a right that does not exist already, of creating a new right.
So you're saying, in your judgment, this bill does or does not create a new right?
Does not create a new right.
So if it exists, this bill perpetuates it. If it does not exist, this bill does not create.
That's the intent.
That's right.
All right. Thank you.
Section 5 is, in a sense, the first part of the replacement of the existing jail standards statutory section. And in the existing law, there is a provision that there shall not be the administration of any physical punishment to any prisoner at any time. Somehow or other, that got omitted from the bill before you. So the subcommittee recommended that after line 23, there would be inserted a new subsection 4, which says not administer any physical punishment to any prisoner at any time. The purpose of that would be just to conform this to existing law that you're replacing. There are in line 24, you get into the first of the major changes made by the subcommittee, recommended by the subcommittee. In this section, two of the following sections, there'll be references to medical treatment of prisoners. Medical treatment of prisoners has been an area of somewhat hot litigation in the prisoners' rights field. And the way the subcommittee dealt with it was this. In line 24, after provide for, insert emergency. So it would say, provide for emergency medical and dental health of the prisoner having written policies for. Then in line 25, delete responsible for and insert review of. So it would be written policies providing for a licensed physician and dentist review of the facility's medical and dental plan. And then because emergency was inserted up on line 24, you delete line 26 altogether and you delete line 27. So the intent of the subcommittee there was to try to shorten up the language referring to medical and dental care and treatment of the prisoner.
Questions from members of the subcommittee? Mm-hmm. Representative Richard.
Could you leave the sub C barbecue again? And I don't understand. Are we deliberately making a policy decision by doing that, confining the responsibility of local officials to only emergency medical care?
Yes.
Was there discussion or testimony concerning the impact of these changes on the little towns with the lockup?
Yes. Lockup is several pages or a couple pages further into the bill, but yes, there's a lot of discussion about that.
We also discussed the cafe across the street from the jail in Jackson County.
We just want
to write down the nitty gritty.
We want to protect the little folks. They're not quite violating the law.
Thanks, Daddy.
The rest of the amendments on the first page of the proposed amendments are just numbering. And they continue this numbering amendment until you get down to line 35.
You're on
page 3 of the bill and page 2 of the amendments, proposed amendments that you're holding. I flipped to page 32. You'll see in line 35, after fed, it was recommended that the word daily be inserted. So it would read that the prisoner shall be fed daily in the facility at least 3 meals at regular times, etc.
Dennis?
Yes.
Representative.
I may have time to stop you here. There's an issue that I don't know if the subcommittee addressed. I believe it occurs on page 4, line 32, whenever we're talking about food. One of the problems with food in lockups and small jails is they tend to, in Multnomah County, it's bologna sandwiches, period. And I would like to propose an amendment here that at least one of these meals be a warm, hot, I don't know.
A warm bologna sandwich?
That's what I'm afraid to come up with. That one of these meals be I'm looking for some statutory language on a warm meal. I'm not going to ask.
Representative Cohen.
We still have some reference to nutrition and plans by somebody.
Well,
Let me go on a little bit. I believe the statute has to be fairly specific. I don't nutritionally adequate and planned is I'm going to plan to have one large piece of bologna and five loaves of bread that they do in the Multnomah County booking facility on the seventh floor of the Multnomah County Courthouse. But I think it would be a good public policy to make one of these meals a warm meal. Now the county's response may be an action of peace. We can't keep these prisoners warm meals. So be it. I do think that for the sake of humanity, some of these people who spend quite a bit of time in these things should deserve one warm meal a day.
Jim.
Representative Smith.
There was a great deal of discussion about this in the subcommittee. Looking a little farther down, I just don't think Dennis has gotten that yet. Maybe it'd be more appropriate to let him get down to the language.
If you're talking about Rocky Butte,
no, I'm talking about Mullen County.
If you want to talk about heating up a meal for any local correctional facility, you do it here. There is no requirement in the bill or the amendment that the meal be heated. So if that's a concern, wherever, and you want to make a motion.
So, if I may continue, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking down to line 38, Dennis. Does that relate to the portion we're still talking about?
Sure.
On page 3.
Yeah.
The way I am handing those mine, it says, will be fed nutritionally adequate meals in accordance with the plan approved by a registered dietitian or the health division.
Right.
It seems to me that if we get any more specific than that in statutory language, we may as well write the menus. And with regard to the Multnomah County booking facility, an awful lot of these people, with the exception of weekend incarceration, are there simply on the chain to await arraignment or some other short function in court, and to prepare a hot meal on the schedule that they're asked to bear for a half day or less becomes a real burden in administration. And I just don't share that concern.
Don't fight with me.
Mr. Chairman. If they're there half a day less, they'll get a hot meal back to Butte. And if they're there more than one day, I'd suggest to those people living off cold bologna sandwiches. That's what they're living off of. And maybe I might be bad mouthing the counties and bad mouthing the corrections division, but I believe unless you make this tight, they're going to push it to the very limit, and it's going to be bologna sandwiches.
You've got a motion?
It's a motion.
Representative Mason moves. Did you state your motion, Representative Mason?
Well, in the line 35, after the phrase meals, and line 38 after the phrase meals, and on page 4, line 30, after the phrase meal, page 4, line 33, after the phrase meal, and I am assuming I have all the bases covered here, that the phrase to be inserted, at least one of which shall be heated, comma, at least one of which shall be heated, comma, including that phrase.
Discussing the motion, you've heard it, Chairman. Representative Lombard.
Well, first of all, in the subcommittee, we really labored over the proper differentiation between a local correctional facility, which is defined by the bill as a facility to hold persons for more than 36 hours. And in making that differentiation, we left in the language you will find on page 3, lines 38 and 39, will require that the meal plan be nutritionally adequate and also in accordance with the plan approved by a registered dietitian or the health division. I feel perfectly comfortable in leaving it up to either the dietitian or the health division to determine whether or not one or more heated meals is appropriate in the plan. We feel quite a burden just by that notion alone on the local correctional facilities to
to obtain that kind of approval. On the next stage, on page 4, since Representative Mason's motion covers that also, down to line 30 and below, we talk only about the lockup facility, which again, going back to your definition, is a facility covering detention up to 36 hours, in, at least in general parlance. We felt, in looking at that, that also to avoid overburdening the local lockup facilities with additional costs, that our requirements simply be they be fed daily at least 3 nutritionally adequate meals. We removed, as I'm sure Dennis will discuss in a while, the requirement that these meals be in accordance with a plan approved by the registered dietitian, because we did not feel that for most lockup facilities this would be an appropriate mandated expense. Somewhere in our testimony we did receive figures as to how many of each of these facilities there in fact are in the state. And I don't remember, do you, Dennis, remember the figures?
Nancy, we have an instant expert here. Nancy, do you want to come up and tell us? Identify yourself for the record, please.
Chairman, I'm Nancy McKay with the League of Oregon Cities. I can tell you for cities how many there are. There are currently 29 lockups, and there are 12 local correctional facilities, and then in addition to that, there would be the county facilities.
Of the city ones, do you know how many have kitchen facilities? Which includes the testing warm
very,
food.
Very few lockups would have kitchen facilities. I think that most of the local correctional facilities would have access to a stove or their heating TV dinners in some cases. So I think it would be less of a burden for them.
And it's appropriation number of the value.
Yes, 29 lockups, 12 local correctional facilities.
Thank you very much, Nancy. Further discussion? The motion by Representative Mason will require that daily there be at least 3 meals, at least one of which will be heated. Chairman may comment editorially, Representative Mason. I don't see that your motion would prevent there being served hot bologna sandwiches. It seems to me that that's a...
Again, you're absolutely right. Again, we're trying to legislate good judgment. I would like to comment, maybe the committee will be disposed towards separate correctional facilities and lockups. But I think the motion stands principles there. I would like to argue for the motion I've seen people stay in that booking facility for quite a long time up there, and they're fed cold bologna sandwiches up for quite a long time, and I don't believe that unless you put it in statute, it's ever going to be anything but cold bologna sandwiches. And that includes any person that happens to get picked up on Friday night on a DUIL, and for some reason by fortune doesn't get released until Monday morning.
You heard the motion, clerk will call roll.
No. Cummins?
No.
Bergman?
No.
Lombard?
No.
Mason?
Yes.
Richard? Rexford?
No.
Smith?
No.
Gardner?
No.
Hello.
Okay.
Yes, please.
Okay. At the bottom of page 3 of the bill, there is an insertion after the word dietitian, a reference to the health division, so that the meals would be according to a plan approved by either a dietitian or the health division.
That's you're on page 3?
On page 3 of the bill, at the very bottom. That's it for page 3 then. I'll get over to page 4. There's some renumbering. Let's see. In line 4, you'll see a reference to the facility has to be clean and healthful. The subcommittee recommended that you take out the word and healthful because the subcommittee, they couldn't
really see that that was a very meaningful standard. Could very well help for me.
Can I, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Cynthia.
Before we get too far past it, get back to the diet teaching on page 3. I realize you're talking about correcting institutions, correcting facilities, and that means jail, wherein you have as lengthy rest as possible. That was a discussion in the subcommittee about the problems you're going to mandate in a small town where you may have fairly lengthy incarcerations and about cost.
Yeah, the one thing I started intended to point out at the beginning is, surprisingly enough, the testimony was that around the state as a whole, the facilities that exist and the practices they now engage in comply with the bill. One of the effects of the bill is to bless basically what's going on around the state now, and that the testimony was that this should not, it's not intended to increase the cost on the cities or counties very much, if at all. You have to remember, the bill came from the cities and counties, at least.
Well, I have some communications from some small cities that are crying to high heaven about additional cost of nutritionists.
Well, maybe address your comments, Nancy, in case you represent the city. Nancy, do you have any comments? And if you do, please step up.
I have a question to represent the city.
I'm Nancy McKee with the League of Oregon Cities. First of all, I'd like to just correct something you said, Dennis. The bill did not come from the cities and counties. Robin O'Brien and I served as members of a 12 or 14 member committee called the Jail Standards Revision Committee. That committee drafted this legislation, so it isn't coming from either association. The cities have had some concerns about the fiscal impact of several sections of the bill. One of them relates to the dietitian, the need to have a dietitian on staff, on retainer, whatever. And the problem, I think, is complicated because there's no stipulation in the bill saying how often that has to take place.
Okay. And that's why we included the health division.
Some of the same complaints I've got, Chairman, if I can continue to refer to the problem as it relates to the medical system. Now, I don't think any of us want to be monsters and have somebody lose a death or have an illness that isn't attended, but I know as a matter of fact that that isn't the case now, even in some of the smaller ones where I'm getting my complaints. You have medical help and you have it fast if you've got an injured or potentially ill person. That should be. But this bill bothered some of the people who were here testifying, even later communicated with me, saying we don't know how long we're going to have to keep a physician available. It appears that he will have to be available and on call and in some manner routine 24 hours a day, every day of the week. Every day of the week. Likewise, a dietitian. Now, my question really is to members of the subcommittee, is that or is that not correct? Are my people hollering in the
I think,
at Shadow?
Said that there are I don't know just when your call came in, because there's always a little communication gap there, but Nancy addressed a lot of those issues before the subcommittee, and the bill was originally drafted would have mandated a lot of things that the bill now does not. For instance, I think you'd have pretty much had to have a doctor on call or on contract to be on call 24 hours a day. Now we changed that. There should be medical facilities available, but you won't have to put somebody on an expensive contract. Same with the dietitian. The dietitian was going to have to bless every meal. Well, a lot of cities don't have dietitians, but by allowing the health division for a dietitian, because there were some places that had dietitians to do it, we probably lowered the cost substantially without reducing the quality of the regulation.
Again, to be sure I'm clear before I vote on this. This bill is not to increase jail standards, then that's not the purpose of this bill.
Representative Mason,
Is this to standardize them?
No, it does increase the standards. The current statutory standards, ORS Chapter 169, apply to local correctional facilities and by reference to lockup. There are 10 standards. Most of those standards are included in this bill for lockup. The standards for both facilities are increased in this bill, more so for local correctional facilities than for lockup. But there's no thing.
How about Bronco's comment that should a prisoner bring a suit that they're going to be able to stand behind the statute and say, well, luckily we touched all the bases. Will this indeed make it easier for the jurisdictions to protect those facilities from legal action on behalf of the prisoner?
Well, I would say that depends on whether you retain the state protection system. And that's the way the if there's no inspection by the state, possibly
would be no enforcement. I think without that kind of protection, this question would or would not protect. I think
they may be a balancing act between increased costs versus the lower level.
Is this increase or decrease liability?
I'm not sure.
See, from line 30 on, there's language about meals and food and nutritionally adequate and all that. The subcommittee compacted that language by, in line 30, deleting A, and that little A at the beginning, and in the same line, after fed, inserting the word daily.
That's page 4, correct?
Yeah.
Line 10? And line 11, I thought we made some changes there that were...
Oh, yeah. I skipped that. How about if I go back to that and I'll
okay,
the food
but you, there is something
sort yeah,
of...
There is an issue there, and yeah. I skipped over it. So, after fed, it says daily, it was recommended that it would say daily, so it would be fed daily in the facility at least 3, and then insert nutritionally there. Adequate meals served at regular times. I'm carrying through to the end of the sentence. Having inserted those words, the subcommittee recommended that subparagraph B, fed nutritionally adequate meals, etc., be out, C, special diets be out, and D, all these requirements on the storage, preparation, distribution, and service of food be out, so that everything after line 32 would be deleted. That was the recommendation on food in lockup. And the testimony there in support of that was that a lot of the lockups don't get their food from within the facility. They may order out and have food brought over. Because
exactly what happened.
Yeah. And so there was, they just didn't want that degree of specificity in the statute.
What then is nutritionally adequate?
I think that would be a reasonable man standard.
And who determines? The prisoner weighs 1,000 feet. Judge eventually, I guess.
No, it would be a mandate to the county or city official who is running the lockup to serve food that a reasonable person would regard as nutritionally adequate. Common sense move. I'll go back up. Paragraph 8 on lines 10 through 12 talks about the written communication between the prisoner and the governor, jail administrator, AG, judge, corrections division, and attorney. The subcommittee debated some proposed changes there and didn't adopt them. It was just raised as an issue. And after the subcommittee considered that, any changes there, I checked with the public defender, the appellate public defender, and also the Prisoners Legal Assistance Project, and they pointed out a court case which I inadvertently skipped over, Wolf against McDonald, which says that as to mail coming in, and Mr. Watson probably want to check me on this, the standard now is that in mail coming in from a prisoner's attorney, it's to be opened and taken out in front of the prisoner, and then if no contraband falls out, you give the letter over to the prisoner. But there is a standard against examination or censorship of communication from the lawyer to the attorney. Now, the law as it stands today, without this bill, says the communication may go either way, from or to the prisoner, between the prisoner, the governor, the jail administrator, AG, judge, corrections division, or his attorney. Those are separate special communications, and they can go either direction. The bill would change that, as you can see, to just having communications coming from the prisoner out. Anything that comes in under the bill would be a proper subject for examination and or censorship under the language of the bill. And I think there is probably a need for a further amendment along the lines of the Wolf against McDonald case, if it is a communication from at least his own attorney. You get the point. The testimony was that it's just too simple to steal a piece of an envelope from an attorney and put contraband in it and send it in, and if the corrections division couldn't open it, or if the local jailer couldn't open it, there'd be a risk involved. And I think the middle ground is that they do open it, but take it out.
I have a question. Where in the proposed amendments did the subcommittee's amendments to that section appear?
They didn't.
Okay.
It was
not adopted.
I thought we passed them on.
I skimmed over the bill.
Okay.
Representative Richard.
Can we just quickly ask the corrections division what their policy is?
Chairman, Representative Richard, our policy in the prison is as the old law is written, both coming and going. But it's not mandated by statute, so by rule, we say if we think there's contraband, we open it in the presence of the prison. But in rewriting this section of the statute, we see a problem for every jail implementing that kind of procedure because of a variety of reasons. And so it was submitted only regarding outgoing.
President, you.
Well, what? I'm not sure of your policy now. What?
On the
incoming letter from an attorney.
It goes through without inspection at the prison. This is jail.
You let the prisoner receive a letter. Let's say he's got a letter from Gardner and Gardner. You do not inspect that?
That's right. From attorneys, judges, governors, that sort of thing. Civil rights.
Mr. Jim.
Richard.
Just to get the information on the record, now under my letterhead to the legislative committee members of the Wives Club has been open for a prisoner to receive it.
You're a special case. I wouldn't trust anything.
Well, I'm just curious. I'd like to pursue
what's
it.
Well,
I don't want to get into your policy too much, What if you open it up something inadvertently, let's say, and it says, why don't you guys get together and organize during meal time and you have another strike?
The suit that your counsel referred to is the one that causes us not to inspect from attorney coming in.
First of all, the reason that you can steal an envelope from an attorney doesn't injure the idea that an attorney's mail can be inspected in. If the envelope is stolen from the attorney, it is not a letter from an attorney.
Now that may be a fine distinction, but if it's a bulky, but they, if the division or a jail administrator suspected it was not truly from an attorney, because this big bulge in the letter, which is obviously some confidence.
Well, well done.
Yeah, he could indeed call the attorney and said, "You send this over," and the attorney more than likely would say no. Therefore, it needs to be a communication to the attorney. Secondly, we have a, the attorneys have a duty not to write letters saying start a riot, organize.
Sometimes they've been known to violate.
That they have. There's a presumption that official duty is performed, and I think there's you can trust members of bar. I personally wouldn't like that. Any mail from attorneys open at any time.
Hey, Dennis, do you want to, while we go through this section, or at some point, give us language that will conform to Wolf versus McDonald?
We could go beyond Wolf, couldn't we?
Sure. We can do anything we want to represent.
Well, sometimes we can talk to them in cases like they're the limit.
After all, that was an intermediate
court. Let's move on if we cover that point.
Okay, I was down to the bottom of page 4. On page 5, well, at the top of page 5, you face that same issue of censorship, possible censorship, at the top. And when the subcommittee dealt with that, there were no recommended changes there. In line 10, you have the deletions proposed of the words "and helpful" for the same reason. In line 12, after 4, provide for, you insert emergency. Line 13, you delete "and dentist responsible for" and insert "review of." Then you delete line 14, 15, and 16. So it's comparable to the treatment that was recommended for the medical aspect of the bill back over in local correctional facilities. What you end up with is 10. Provide for emergency medical and dental health of the prisoner, having written policies providing for a licensed physician review of the facility's medical and dental plan. And that's it. In a local, in a locker. Over on page, that's it for page 5. Over on page 6, line 30. At the end of the line, the word "are," that would be restored, and in line 31, the words "entitled to" would be restored, and the phrase "may be given" would be deleted, so that you'd restore 169.120 to its present state, which would be entitling prisoners to allowance for credit for good time or compensation if they engage in work either inside or outside the facility.
What's it, Rich?
Dennis, the original language was written in the conjunctive so that both allowance for good time and compensation is required, and this new language is written in the alternative.
Right. The subcommittee recommended the restoration of "are entitled to," but they didn't recommend the restoration of the word "and."
That was discussed, Richard. My viewpoint wasn't more by putting the intention of the word "and."
Okay, then that brings you through to the end of the bill. No, there was a question. There was a question in the subcommittee about whether it's constitutional to require somebody to work without pay. And we have a specific constitutional provision on that. Article 1, Section 34 allows involuntary servitude in a penal setting.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Oregon Constitution?
Oregon Constitution.
Has it ever been challenged?
I didn't check.
Okay, let's confirm our vote that House Bill 2073 be amended as presented to the committee with the amendments House Bill 2073, February 19, 1979, both amendments, pages 1, 2, and 3. Discussion. President Smith.
I support the motion and would still like, even after we passed it, to have Dennis work on the language on the mail situation, because that was a concern of mine in the subcommittee.
Okay.
the only other part of the bill that I'm nervous about before passing it out.
Okay.
How about a conceptual amendment to guide me?
Let's deal with this, and then we'll take up that. Okay. I will accept other motions for other amendments. I think Representative Richards has at least one. And we'll take a conceptual amendment.
By way of discussion, Mr. Chair. I'm reluctant to put these out, and I regret I didn't spend more time or any time in the position anybody discussing these with the city board, and I think you take care of most of my objections with amendments that I was prematurely concerned about, but I see some other potential costs that I want to discuss with my small town. Do we have lockups and finally vote today on the amendments pretty well all the way through to preserve the integrity of my position to maybe vote no on the floor.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lombard.
Yes, I'd simply say kind of response to Representative Hughes that the whole direction of the amendment were in fact to lessen the physical impact at the local level. And so I think it would be entirely appropriate to move the amendments. In fact, I've kind of been thinking in the back of my own mind that this is perhaps one bill that we ought to have engrossed after we do it and have it come back to committee so that we have an opportunity to ship copies off to our local people for comment. But suffice to say, the whole gist of the subcommittee's work and the amendments was to take out as much of the adverse physical impacts as we could. So I think the bill would certainly be in much better shape for our small communities. And I might add, the city of Ashland has a lockup facility, one of the few in our area, which was very definitely, under the original bill, very adversely affected, and I think much less so now.
Okay.
If Mr. Chairman, to continue the dialogue, and I'll knock it off, if you would go, if the committee would be inclined to go this route, I suggest that even at the risk of further congesting our heavy scheduled bill, to bring that back to the amendment in gross, I would vote for the amendment in order to give my self time to review and consult with my people. But other than under those circumstances, I don't understand the motion right now to be that. It's just an amendatory motion. Would that come separately, Mr. Chairman? Bring the bill back.
It's my intention of the to attempt to adopt it. At that point, to take other amendments that may or may not be adopted by the committee. And then I would have no problem. In fact, I think it's a good idea to send the bill out, have a printed book, and send it back. It's an important bill, and it's certainly one that we want to make sure that we're not having any adverse effect upon it. Okay, the further discussion on adoption of the amendment as outlined. Objection. Hearing
on sword.
Under further amendment to the
office,
Representative Richards.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that on page 6 of the bill, line 31, we delete the word or following the deleted word on and replace the word and.
Okay, Representative Richards has moved on page 6, line 31 of the bill, deletion of the word or after time. And reinsertion of the bracket language and discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Richards.
Although I can't cite the volume number or the line number, there is a recent report issued by the National Council on Crime and Delinquency which speaks to the positive rehabilitative effects that prisoners pay for work rendered and to the financial obligations of prisoners, both legal fees and families on public assistance in generally poverty conditions, to which some contribution by prisoners received some pay for his work can be made.
I just feel it's good public policy and follows the constitutional mandate to look toward rehabilitation.
We had some testimony at the subcommittee. I wonder if we could maybe briefly have that again for the benefit of the public.
Do you remember who that was?
Well, I thought we had some
from the
Correction
Division. Well, I thought we did too.
So, Watson, would you like to comment on this post in the hand?
Representative Rutherford at the subcommittee, the testimony was not given by me, but by Mr. Brandt, who's one of the jail inspectors. He reported to the subcommittee that there was concern at the local level regarding the cost that might be imposed if there was a mandatory, but then the question was asked, well, the way the law reads now, it looks like it is, and the answer was, I think they're just not living up to the current law. Now, where that puts people, if you put it back in, it's probably no different than where they are now, but it's my understanding the fact is they're not being paid in some counties now because of cost.
Representative Smith?
My hand's just resting in the air, but as long as you give me the floor, I'm going to oppose the motion.
Representative Mason, you also need to pull out the phrase
for both.
Yeah.
Yes, I speak in favor of the motion. I'm a little appalled that counties facilities aren't doing it if it already is in the law. I don't
think so. Also.
I think that because they aren't doing it, that's the reason why we're amending the law. I think that's very, very, very poorly if both us and them, if that were to be the case. I hope that isn't the case. I hope they really are doing it.
Okay, I'm going to treat that as a friendly amendment to your motion, Representative Richard, that in line 31, the addition of the motion you made, that deletion of the word for both. Further discussion of the motion.
Just clarification, Mr. Chairman. On the same line, the may be given, it still stands, right?
So that has been stricken in the amendments that we have adopted.
So this mandate, mandate both rather than give some judgmental capability.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. You've heard the motion. There's further discussion. If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Davis?
No.
Cohen?
Aye.
Cohenmeyer?
No.
Lombard?
No.
Mason?
Aye.
Richard?
Aye.
Rutherford?
No.
Smith?
No.
Gardner?
Fail. Through the motion?
Yes.
So Mason?
Line, page 4, line 11. And page 5, line 2. Delete the word. Well, insert after the word to, insert the phrase in both places or from. This is page 4, line 11, where it reads, referring to communication, about when written communication to, and then we insert the word or from. And then we go to page 5, line 2, communication 2, insert the word from, and then drop down, and back end drop down on page 4 to line 12. I think we would have to, that would be numerically consistent as it is.
Can I make it? The existing law simply says delete outgoing. And they say written communications with. I should have pointed
that
out.
That's fine with me. I know.
But I should have pointed that out.
That's what I said here.
Was that the subcommittee?
Yeah. Okay, so I haven't pointed to the motion yet. The sense of your motion would be to have it read forward without examination or censorship each prisoner's written communications with the governor, jail administrator, attorney general, judge, corrections division, or his own attorney.
That's correct.
Okay, so Representative Mason's moved in line 10 on page 4, the word outgoing stricken, and on line 11 of the same page, the word to be stricken, and the word with added. And then language to conform with that on page 5, section 5, lines 1 through 3, discussion. What's the desperate?
I think I would rather see something along the lines of the Wolf case, which would allow in certain cases of instructions, not censorship, examination of the correspondence.
Okay, further discussion. Representative Smith.
I think it's coming back to me now why this, which was late in our agenda that day, was left alone. If you remove outgoing, presumably a letter going out from the penitentiary is not going to contain anything of any real danger to those within the penitentiary. However, it's the incoming that creates a problem. Secondly, it seems to me my complaint at that time was that communications I was receiving from my clients in the penitentiary were substantially delayed. By the time they reached me, they were old news, and it bothered me a great deal to get a week-old letter from the penitentiary. And I was more concerned about the individual having the right to get a speedy question out to me, because I, on the outside, presumably have the resources to give a speedy reply. And some of my concern over the amendment that I did note, that Dennis just suggested again, is coming back to me now.
Well, I think this is a tempest in a teapot. I think that Representative Mason made an excellent point earlier, that at the point where the Corrections Division would receive mail from any of these five different sources, or potentially from those sources, that they would be able to check if there was any doubt in their mind whether or not, in fact, that was a communication from either the governor, the jail administrator, the attorney general, judge, corrections division, or the inmate's attorney. And upon finding out that there was not a communication from any of those people, that communication would cease to be from that person. Secondly, I don't see any of those people, if in fact they would send a communication, sending any kind of contraband or any material that should not be sent into the prisoner. So I don't see if there's a problem with the language as presented. And I will support the motion.
Call for the question.
Further discussion. I'm going to oppose it, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to oppose it because of the occasional idiot illustration. And it has happened. Where you get a razor blade sent in, and you have another prisoner's life or welfare at stake. And I don't think there's any reason to, for anybody on this panel or in this room, to think for 1 minute that all the inspection is done meticulously. It's done by people to whom the job is delegated, and they can have no particular reason to open a letter that can have a very lethal wound. You're not talking here about civil rights on the outside in the free world. You're talking about desperate people. And they've gone through the process, and I'm very sorry about the potential inconvenience. I think the lawyers have shown that, represented by Representative Smith, they can have very innovative and quick ways to get word to their client. They can visit, too.
Okay.
And I'll argue against it on the floor.
Further discussion, please. If not, clerk, call the roll.
Christian Davis?
No.
Cohen?
No.
Cronemeyer?
No.
Lombard?
No.
Mason?
Aye.
Richard?
Aye.
Rutherford?
No.
Smith?
No.
Aye. Fail. Further motion on fail.
Fail.
If not, the chair would move that House Bill 2073 is amended
consent to the floor that the recommendation be printed and engraved and returned to this committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering if committee council can't prepare something in line with the Wolf decision to cover Fort Collins.
Why don't you just do that, and then we'll have that as a possible amendment to the bill when it returns to. Okay. Further discussion on the motion. Is there objection to the motion?
Yes. Just you're talking about the Wolf.
No, I'm talking about sending the bill to the floor with the recommendation to be printed and engrossed and returned to the committee.
Yes.
Okay. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Cohen? Aye. Romine? Aye. Lombard? Aye. Mason? No. Richard? Aye. Rutherford? Aye. Smith? Aye. Gardner? Aye. Pass. Okay, move this Senate Bill 68.
Where the court finds that foreclosure is not sought primarily for the purpose of evading the requirements of regulations or ordinances adopted pursuant to ORS 92.025 to 92.160.
Okay. Let's go to two others.
Okay. These are amendments I'm reading now that arose out of discussions I had with 1,000 Friends of Oregon, Representative Rutherford, Representative Cohen, and I don't believe that I had discussions with anybody else proposing these. I also had discussions with Mr. Bonner. These are all things that I put together after everybody. Here's one that. Partition land does not include division of land resulting from foreclosure by a financial institution of a lien or a recorded contract for the sale of real property. That's one that I don't think very meritorious, but it's covered with another one. Partition land does not include division of land resulting from foreclosure of a lien or a recorded contract for the sale of real property if the division produces no parcel which is smaller than the minimum size allowable under the zoning ordinance, if any, which governs the land divided. That also, I don't think anybody was really interested in. It's just a station along the way to getting to the last one.
those are the proposed amendments. What's the committee's place as far as the bill is concerned?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
I have trouble with any of the amendments because I have discussed it with financial institutions with which I'm acquainted. And I get to remain in a potential cloud, or at least a question about title in certain cases, if you, even with the best of intentions, try to sort of potentially clarify this. And I think the only one that's even moderately acceptable, I think Dennis has put his finger on, that's the first one. And even that mild of change is objectionable. And even if it weren't to the individual local bank, I think it is to the financing fraternity, if I can use that term, because I think that the sale of mortgages and trade in the financial community just simply does not put that kind of a piece of property, that kind of a cloud, or even a possible cloud on it, into a to the category of a marketable security. And I think we can take a look at this again in the future. We can see if we do any potential harm, and I think that the bill ought to go out as
I think the bill came back to the committee based upon a concern over the avoidance of land use policy, either intentionally or unintentionally, and the possible harm to persons who might ultimately purchase the land after it had been partitioned through one of these sales. So for those two reasons, it came back to the committee. We heard, of course, as you know, extensive testimony in which the financial institutions made their case of their concern over the present state of the law and their need for change. We heard, of course, the testimony of persons who were advocates of land use indicating their concern and presented squarely with a dilemma as to what to do. It doesn't seem that there is a reasonable statutory language that can accommodate both points of view, except that there does seem to be general agreement between both parties that the purpose of the bill is not to avoid the land use laws of the state of Oregon. I asked specifically Mr. Bronner and the Commissioner for the Banks, Mr. Olin, if that was the purpose, and they both indicated it was not. And further, we received assurances that in the event that this is used to avoid escape the application of land use laws, that the financial institutions would be back here in 2 years attempting to close any loopholes that might inadvertently be created by this bill. Because of that assurance and because of the clear record, I think, that has been created by this committee, that the purpose is not to avoid the Oregon land use laws, I would be prepared to support the bill leading the committee in the form that it did. I would like to read a statement of legislative intent prior to the vote and see if the committee agrees with that.
Mr. Redford, I'm going to treat that as a motion, so you go ahead and read your
The statement of legislative intent, which is one with which I would agree, and I would hope the committee would agree, is prepared by Mr. Sherman, who is the counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association, and it states as follows. The purpose of Senate Bill 68 is to cure a technical defect in ORS Chapter 92 regarding foreclosures of interest in real property. It is the intent of this committee that Senate Bill 58 be interpreted to exclude from the definition of partition land only those divisions of land which result from the foreclosure of bona fide interest in real property. It is not the intent of this committee that Senate Bill 58 and the exclusion provided for therein be used as a device to circumvent the provisions of Oregon land use laws.
Okay. Is there any objection to that being the legislative intent of the committee?
May I ask that I'll make that suggestion if the bill has a favorable vote. I'll hold my suggestion.
Okay. Representative Rutherford has moved that Senate Bill 68 be sent to the floor of the DPAC recommendation.
Well, Mr.
Representative Cohen.
Yeah, I guess. I think one of the best things that's come out of all this is that before us we have a suggestion of possibly how to deal with my concern, which was the third party who gets in on a piece of property down the line that does not have currently any use that's practical. And there is finally, I think, a suggestion that's come from Mr. Sherman and others that we deal with it in the context possibly of the title company search and actually dealing with that on that interchange. And so I'd be inclined to go along with the motion to send it back or do that with the legislative intent clearly as Mr. Rutherford has put it, and then with some commitment on our part, you know, personally to go in and look and find some way to do the consumer protection on the back end.
Anyone else have a speech?
If not, please call the roll.
Aye. Colin?
Aye.
Romeyer?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richard?
No.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Can I move that as part of the measuring out statement submitted to the floor by staff, that the statement by Representative Rutherford be included in quotation marks as representing the legislative intent of the committee?
Okay. Representative Cromeyer has moved that the statement read by Representative Rutherford prior to the vote concerning this bill be made part of the major summaries that is sent to the members on the floor. Is there discussion? Is there objection? That's the order. Okay. As an editorial aside, I'm going to have a difficult time determining whether Representative Rutherford or Cohen is going to carry this major on the floor.
Might give Representative Cohen, Mr. Chairman, the opportunity to lay the groundwork for her bill.
That's possible. Okay. My intent would be to try to, at some point today, and I'm emphasizing the word today, to work through the agenda. We have, I believe, two more bills on the agenda. This one, 2017, and House Bill 2052. How long
can I make a suggestion, Mr. Chairman?
Let me excuse
myself for a moment from the committee and go over the caucus and see if we can arrange to be 10 or 15, 20 minutes late.
Well, 2052 is going to take a lot more time than 15 or 20 minutes.
Okay.
I understand the government's going to meet with the
430. Yeah, we're going
to
get out of here.
I will not be able to return, Mr. Chairman, because we'll have to speak to you and you and you.
What's the committee's desire at this point? We have one or two possible alternatives. Either we can take up 2052 at this time and attempt to work through it and delay the minority members from the caucus, or we can adjourn at this point and have 2052 as the first item of business at the next work session of the full committee. What's the committee's preference?
In light of the importance of 2052, I don't think it should be hammered through, and I think that we probably ought to make a first decision.
Any objection to that? Okay, if not, we'll stand adjourned with the Representative Lombard.
Do we have that much problem with 2017 that we can't move on it?
Well, Representative Frohmeyer?
Well, we had a report by staff council on this, then you folks can get an idea very quickly of the dimensions of the issue.
Okay.
And I think that'll give you a sense of it.
Dennis?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, 2017. Wait, Dennis, the question is when is the next session of full committee?
Friday.
Yeah. It'll be the first item of business. I'm sorry that we've delayed it this long.
Friday at 1:30.
That's clear, man.
Dennis?
Okay.
At the present time, because of the wording of 419.476, it's possible to pick up a child, let's say, in Oregon on the allegation of conduct committed in another state and adjudicate that child's case in Oregon on the basis of written reports or whatever else the court could look to, perhaps witnesses from the other state, but the child has no ability legally to require the presence of any witness that he or she may wish to call in his or her own defense. And this bill would give the subpoena power to juveniles so that if they were being adjudicated on that kind of conduct from another state, they'd be able to require the attendance from the other state of people who might know about the case. The reason that this even arises is because Oregon allows juveniles to be adjudicated in the state for conduct from another state. Another approach to the problem would be simply to delete the power of the Oregon Juvenile Court to consider adjudication on the basis of conduct from another state. So rather than worrying about subpoenaing and bringing in people from another state, just tell the court that it can't consider, say, allegations of burglary from California or Washington. The subcommittee recommended that the bill do pass without change, but instructed me to prepare a proposed amendment for your consideration, which would eliminate what's called extraterritorial jurisdiction, the jurisdiction of the court to consider conduct from another territory. And I've got that in front of me. And the only reason I suggested that you defer action on the bill today is simply because it could be a somewhat extensive debate on whether or not to eliminate the extraterritorial jurisdiction. The part about the bill itself authorizing a subpoena power isn't that difficult. That's the lesser of the two issues involved. So, shall I pass this out? Do you want to debate it? Do you want to drop it?
Pass it
out. And may I speak to this while we're... I had the opportunity to talk to the Juvenile Justice Association band a couple of weeks ago, and I brought up this issue specifically, pointing out that we were going to increase the subpoena power, but that one option before the committee would be with all territorial jurisdiction. And I raised to them at the time that we'd heard one argument from Ms. McFarlane of Legal Aid that it was her view that extraterritorial jurisdiction was unconstitutional. And I went into unanimous and quite thoughtful opposition from the judges, among them the judge from Clatsop County, Columbia County, Hood River County, Jackson County, all of whom, of course, and Multnomah County. All these judges, of course, represent areas where people go across the river or they go across the border, and the judges have found that in terms of the dispositional alternatives, it's much better to be able to take care of the kid in the community than work out very elaborate reciprocal arrangements with California or Washington for taking care of the child's problem and adjudicating whatever the behavior is. And on that basis, I have, to the extent that I supported it, at least pulled back from my view that we ought to abolish extraterritorial jurisdiction. I'm certainly not ready to take that step based upon that kind of judicial reaction, at least. And bear in mind, of course, these were judges, juvenile directors. There are other points of view, but they really held to that quite strongly on the basis that this is the best way for the kid. That's my report.
It seems, before I recognize you, Mr. Richard, it seems to me that if we're going to allow the court to exercise that, the least we can do is allow the kid security at the state witnesses attend.
Quite agree. No problem with that.
So I guess that's the policy decision. Representative Richards?
I've got a couple of questions for the committee council to refresh all the memories. Are adults now subject to extraterritorial jurisdiction? That is being charged with and tried for crimes by other states?
No.
So the zoning policy we're applying to juveniles?
That's right.
Okay. Do all other states, or how many other states, and how about our neighboring states, California and Washington, maintain the public policy of extraterritorial jurisdiction?
I wish I could remember. There may be a rhetorical question. I don't remember whether Washington and California allow it. There was testimony on that point, and I just can't recall.
It's my impression that at least Washington does, because I've been talking to one of the judges from up from Representative Bugis' country at this conference. I got the impression that the judges had informal working relationships with each other across the Columbia, and that would only have to be possible if they were.
Okay. Further comment?
Only, Mr. Chairman, to say that I think it's a matter, just so those who weren't in the subcommittee understand this, of extending to the juvenile the same basic rights of acquiring testimony by virtue of out-of-state using out-of-state witnesses and so forth. That is present in court as to a person who has achieved majority, and I think it's only a matter of fairness.
So I treat that as a motion?
Yeah, I'll move.
Representative Bugis moves the Council 2017 to present before the pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Lombard.
Was there any sentiment there? Notice I got a copy of Harl Hodge's letter to you, Mr. Chairman, expressing his desire that if the juvenile be allowed to have the out-of-state subpoena power, that the prosecutor also have that authority. I don't recall we discussed that in subcommittee.
I don't think that we did. I think we received Hoss's letter after we acted in subcommittee.
I think it would be appropriate at least to discuss that for a second. What's the situation today in an adult proceeding? Do both the state and the defense have the opportunity to clean up out-of-state witnesses?
Let me check. I believe that's the case.
May I inquire on a... Maybe I'll address this to Representative Fulmer. I've never had this come up, but I can recall in juvenile case. Can you also then subpoena records and materials that are outside the state when you have a juvenile here for the convenience of whomever?
I couldn't give an authoritative answer.
Would the out-of-state juvenile court records, for example, of prior findings of jurisdiction in the other state be admissible here?
I'd assume they'd be admissible under official records. Dr. DeBay's coming.
I would think that if you can subpoena the witness, you can give them a subpoena just in case.
Yeah,
require them to bring the documents, and I think that the documents would be admissible under the official records exception to the hearsay rule.
Okay. I think that probably the concern that Mr. Haas raises can be taken care of very easily in line 30 of the bill. The child or any person obtained by half the child or the state may secure the attendance of out-of-state witnesses. Just add those words.
I would move the addition of...
Okay. Representative Rutherford moves it in line 30 after the word child, second child, the word for the state. He added. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Flomeyer.
The only thing I wondered about is how this jives from 136.623 to 637. Is that something that describes the procedure only available to private parties, so that it would be anomalous to have this say included in it?
We have counsel check that.
I'm checking now, and I just went through it once cursorily, but equally applicable.
All right. I think that's right.
Okay. Further discussion on the proposed amendment.
You need a withdrawal of. Retraction of my motion. Don't forget I made a motion.
Yeah, you just did that.
Okay.
Okay. Is there further discussion on the amendment? Representative Richards.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I feel that it's preposterous that we are burdening the taxpayers of the state of Oregon, both for the district attorney's office and for the cost of private counsel, probably in an indigent case, for a public policy decision made by another state that may not, in fact, even be a matter of law in the state of Oregon, or may be the reverse decision in the state of Oregon. And it's also preposterous that we incur this public expense only for juveniles and not for any adults. And I at the same time, I feel like if we're not going to make the policy decision of abandoning extraterritorial jurisdiction, we need to improve the law and grant this benefit. I just feel real frustrated with the whole idea of extraterritorial jurisdiction as an appropriate public policy.
Okay. The further discussion on the proposed amendment, I take that nature of objection to the amendment. Are you objecting to the proposed
amendment? Advance warning of a minority report, Mr.
Chairman.
Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing no objection to the amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Dugas moves the House for 2017 as amended to be sent to the floor for due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
On that, Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we've ever had a fiscal impact in connection with the bill.
One apparently attached here. Says that it's not presently known how many witnesses would be subpoenaed from out of state. They must be paid 10 cents per mile, $5 per day for travel and witness costs, as outlined in 136.623 to 637. These costs are paid by the juvenile court from Canada.
That's funding money.
I just don't think there's any way to figure, but there's going to be some.
Montgomery County said they had 6 weeks old a year.
For that off?
Yeah.
6 or 7 a year?
6 or 7 a year. Legal aid told me they had 6 or 7 tough ones.
That's why Julie mentioned that figure on.
But I guess the question is, the river folks have a flood government, I'll bet you. But this way we know. If we don't know anybody over the
time. I do not think it's a huge fiscal impact.
I think it's drinking beer and guilt.
Can I put that down here? No huge fiscal impact.
No.
Representative Smith?
Representative Gardner, did you happen to mention Washington's position on that?
I haven't.
I'm not just sure with you. I had a side conversation with Senator Lombard. Washington County does a forum pretty much on this sort of thing. Washington County views this as a minor fiscal impact on the county.
Further discussion on Representative Dugas' motion. If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Dugas?
Aye.
Cohen?
No.
Schoenmeyer?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
No.
Richards?
Nope.
Rexford?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes. Is there further business to come before the committee?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Richards.
There's notice of possibility filing a minority report on the
case. Okay. Your notice is hereby noted. Is there further business to come before the committee? If not, we stand here.
Okay, first.